Meeting of the House Government Efficiency Committee to order, and we are going to start off with a public hearing on House Bill 770. So I open a public hearing on House Bill 770. Senator Brown, would you like to come up and tell us a little bit about this? Do we have anybody else?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Could I have Anton Minsar, who's chair of the Secretary of Private Unit of the Umatilla, up with me as well?
Absolutely.
And Levon.
Senator, you can have anybody join.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, then we'll just call them all up. Levon, why don't you come on up as well, please? And I'd also like to recognize, well, good morning for the record. I'm State Senator Kate Brown, Senate District 7. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for getting Senate Bill 770 a hearing. This bill was introduced by myself and Senator Clarno at the request of the Tribes and the Commission on Indian Services. The committee's information, I've essentially been on the Commission on Indian Services. It was my first legislative committee appointment in November of 1991, but for a brief respite, I've been on the commission my entire time. It's been a great honor and a really incredible working experience. Senate Bill 770 directs the agency of the state of Oregon to continue building productive working relationships with the 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon. Unlike many other states, Oregon has been working hard to promote communication and cooperation with tribal governments. Senate Bill 770 will make sure the effort in Oregon continues as an example for other states seeking to improve their state and tribal relations. And we do believe that this legislation is precedent-setting nationally. It builds on Executive Order 9630 that Governor Kitzhaber signed in May of 1996 at the request of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services, and it acknowledges the critical role the legislative branch plays in setting state and tribal relations policy. And the reason we want it set in statute is so that the impact of the executive order will last beyond the term of this particular governor. We believe the savings in terms of this legislation is twofold. It lessens the chance that a state and tribal dispute will end up in court, because the government-to-government process sets in place a way for the state and tribes to learn about each other's concerns and talk problems out before they become a crisis, frankly. And secondly, it helps reduce costs to taxpayers by optimizing each government's resources and maximizing efficient delivery of government services. With that, I will turn it over to Chair Minsar. I did want to recognize Ron Brainerd, who's chair of the Coos, Umpqua, and Salusala tribes, who is here in the room as well, and I don't believe he's testifying. Thanks, Ron, for being here. Fire, go ahead. Fire away.
Thank you. good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Anton Minthorn, and I am the chairman of the Board of Trustees, the governing body of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. I appreciate and welcome the opportunity to appear before this committee to express our strong support for Senate Bill 770, a bill that would legislate the government-to-government policy and initiatives between the state of Oregon tribes that begin with Governor Kitzhaber's Executive Order 9630. Historically, tribal governments have most interacted with the federal government. We entered into treaties with the United States. It is the federal government that owes a trust responsibility to tribes, and it is Congress that possesses broad constitutional authority to legislate in the area of Indian affairs. Nonetheless, there is an increasing need for the interaction of tribal and state governments. Consider these examples. Natural resources. The state and tribe share common interests such as water, fish, and wildlife that require our joint management. Gaming. Congress increasingly requires states and tribes to work together on important governmental objectives such as tribal-state compacts to address casino gaming concerns. Land. Recently, the Department of Interior regulations were issued regarding taking lands into trust. Education. Tribes and states share a common interest in improving the education of our youth. Many of our elementary and high school students attend state schools. Developing a trained workforce for our tribal government and enterprises will require the joint efforts of our governmental agencies. I have no doubt that there will be a continuing need for a cooperative and constructive working relationship between the state and Oregon tribes as we witness the continued downsizing of the Bureau of Indian Affairs and other federal agencies that have historically operated as a buffer between tribal and state governments. The Umatilla tribe's commitment to a government-to-government relationship with the state is not a hypothetical one. We have codified our commitment to by passage of Resolution 9974B, which established the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla policy regarding a government-to-government relationship with the state. The resolution required our department directors to identify a contact person for interactions with state agencies and required annual reporting on interactions with and cooperative initiatives involving state programs. The point of these government-to-government contacts is to produce improvements in our respective governmental programs. We have already seen successes in the area of social services, natural resources, efforts in the area of salmon restoration and quality improvement, and water quality improvement, in economic development and transportation planning. With the institutionalization of the government-to-government relationship between tribes and states in SB 770, I expect the list of cooperative tribal state government initiatives to expand. The state of Oregon and the 9 federally recognized tribes in the state have much to gain by cooperative working relationship. While the Umatilla tribes has not always agreed with its state and local government counterpart, our experience shows that there is more to be gained by cooperating than by being at odds with one another. The Umatilla tribes, like the other tribes in Oregon, have made significant contributions to and sacrifices for the state and its non-Indian residents, including title to millions of acres of land and the devastation of sacred salmon runs in rivers throughout the region. The government-to-government relationship that would be institutionalized by SB 770 can and should address problems associated with these historic tribal contributions to our state, as well as to modern-day problems. We have and must continue to work cooperatively with state agencies for salmon restoration, environmental protection, economic development, education, social services, and health care concerns. SB 770 will not resolve all our differences. Rather, it commits the state to a policy of interaction on a government-to-government basis with their tribal governmental counterparts to address problems of mutual concern. It is important that this policy established by Oregon's current governor be institutionalized with the passage of SB 770 so that we have the tools to constructively and cooperatively address issues of mutual concern with our respective governmental capabilities into the future. Thank you for the opportunity to address your committee on this important bill. For the record, I am enclosing a copy of the Board of Trustees Resolution 9974B and my recent comments at the annual government-to-government meeting between the state and Oregon tribes. I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Why don't we hold our questions and go ahead, Ms. Lovett.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is LaVon Lobert Edmo. I serve as the chair of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services, and I'm here this morning to urge your support of passage of Senate Bill 770. Our 25-year-old commission serves as an advisory board to you, the legislatures, and to the executive branch. Our commission monitors state tribal relations and makes suggestions for improvements. It is a forum that has a high level of representation, including 4 tribal chairs, 5 tribal council members from Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes currently sit on our commission, in addition to legislators, Senator Kate Brown and Representative Greg Smith, and 2 Indians representing non-reservation Indians in Oregon are appointed by the Speaker and the Senate President. Without doubt, the relationship building that has occurred under Executive Order 9630 between state agencies and Oregon tribes over the past years is quite impressive. One time a year, the governor, tribal leaders, the Commission on Indian Services, and state agency and tribal representatives meet to assess the conditions of state-tribal relations. 3 to 4 times a year, clusters or issue-oriented work groups meet to tackle the specifics of government-to-government work. The Natural Resources Cluster, which is an example, has the following participants: the Department of Forestry, Department of Environmental Quality, Department of State Lands, Water Resources, Department of Land Conservation and Development, Agriculture, Department of Energy, the Military Department, and all of their tribal counterparts. Had their most recent meeting in Salem on February 7th. The agencies and tribes identify areas of shared concern and consider interagency cooperation in other ways to address issues such as watershed health, the Oregon plan process, and potential for tribal involvement. Briefing on air quality planning, national firefighting programs, state landfill and removal program, cultural resource protection planning, and state law, and a review of proposed legislative measures that may affect tribal interests. The purpose of the cluster meeting is to explore common areas of interest or concern and to discuss whether and what type of coordinated action might be appropriate. The Natural Resource Cluster may discuss joint fire management. The Cultural Resource Cluster may discuss training and archaeological laws for state police who have the statutory responsibility in that area but may not understand what is a cultural resource. The Public Safety Cluster may discuss a process to notify tribes when tribal youth are taken into custody so there can be some joint planning for the eventual transition of the tribal youth when released. The goal is to increase chances that youth will not re-enter the system. The Economic Development and Community Service Cluster has an ongoing discussion of infrastructure, possibilities of joint projects, leveraging federal and grant dollars for the benefit of all Oregonians. In addition, there is a lot of discussion about employers who are interested in locating in Oregon and want to know what it's like to do business in Indian country. I could give you many more examples where important and strong relationships are being built under the government-to-government process. I would be happy to provide for you, if you would like to, a copy of the most recent annual report that the state agencies make on their individual work with Oregon tribes. Senate Bill 770 will encourage state agencies to keep exploring positive ways to work with tribes. Senate Bill 770 recognizes the need to communicate, to learn about each other's governmental structures, priorities, and programs, to see where it might make sense for the different governments to try to work together on some common issues. Many states have rocky relationships with tribes. Many states are trying to copy our Oregon model. I myself assisted the Alaska Native community in training them for some negotiations that they were undertaking to have a similar order signed by their government. And our executive director, Karen Quigley, went to Wisconsin and made a presentation for the Wisconsin tribes, and they are very interested in copying our model. All Oregonians gain by the legislative branch involvement in a respectful approach to government-to-government relations with Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes. I urge your support of Senate Bill 770, and I thank you very much for hearing this bill this morning.
Thank you very much. Other questions for our panel? Representative Gerard?
Yes, good morning. I really don't care who responds, but I'd like to know what is the tribal position in regards to amending the Endangered Species Act to consider the economic input on communities.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, there are 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon. Mr. Minthorn, Chair of the Umatilla, may be able to speak to this particular tribe. Levon Lobert Admiral probably cannot speak to any of the particular tribes, so.
Would you state the question again, please?
Yes, sir. What is the Confederated Tribes' position on amending the Endangered Species Act to take into consideration the impact on local economies? And this is in direct relation to what's happening in Klamath County.
I'm not sure what tribe's particular position specifically to that Endangered Species Act relative to protecting or local economies or the economies in the area. But just an example of Umatilla's approach or philosophy as it's working with its local stakeholder interests or community interests. We are always very considerate of that. We have worked with the local communities on the Umatilla Basin Project that had restored water and salmon to the Umatilla River, at the same time preserving the local irrigation economy. We are similarly doing the same in the Walla Walla Basin that we are working with the local interests, stakeholder interests there, to again to restore water and salmon to the Walla Walla River, but always taking into consideration our relationship with the people that live in that valley, and also relative to their economic interests. But I cannot specifically talk about the ESA, but it is something that I would consider.
Comment, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Gerard.
If that is your position, then I certainly congratulate you on doing that.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Hill.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm ready. So I want to be ready to go to work session.
Okay. Well, we have a couple more people that would like to testify, but
okay. They can. So just that, you know, longer people talk, you know, the risk, you know, I'm ready to go.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to compliment Chair Minthorn on the wonderful job that your tribe is doing. I was fortunate enough to be able to visit the tribe a few weeks ago, and I'm very impressed with all that you've been able to do with the hatcheries and your land, and I enjoyed meeting you and spending time with you, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Grant and Karens? Oh, fine. Louis Pitt?
My name is Louis Pitt, Jr. I'm Director of Government Affairs and Planning. Good morning. Neith Maitsky. The Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, which I'm Director of Government Affairs and Planning, is definitely for Senate Bill 770. I've got, I got whispered in my ear just a moment ago by somebody, a senator, first name Kate, to keep it short. Respective, I think, of Representative Hill's wishes is that sounds like he's got some favorable feelings towards this. It's an opportunity to talk to you about some of the whys in Indian country. We're definitely for this because, as Chairman Minthorn talked about from the Umatilla tribes, again, I'm from Warm Springs, is that we can do more working with folks rather than working against folks. And, you know, you've got to understand who you're talking to or who's talking that to. These are peoples that at one point were at war with the United States, is that this is not something to be taken lightly. And this was for reasons of principle on our part. committee assistant, I did hand some things out right there. I think the reasons I think there's discussion about who are we as a people. In the handout that you have, the United States in 1787 made a statement about what's called, I call it the utmost good faith statement. It was about these lands long before there was a state of Oregon, long before there was, I think, even Washington was thought of, that that utmost good faith shall always be observed towards these Indians. And one Middle Oregon tribes, Warm Springs tribes, is one of those tribes, so is Umatilla and the nine recognized tribes in Oregon, of course. And it states clearly their lands and property will never be taken from them without their consent, and in their property, rights, and liberty. So within the state of Oregon, we have, before the state of Oregon, we had the United States Continental Congress in 1787, back in the, just the Revolutionary Day, stating clearly that we own these lands and properties. The treaty, there's a treaty we negotiated with the United States, a contract and subunits of the United States, which are the states, is that these treaties are the supreme law of the land to be honored by the states. Our treaty clearly reserves a number of rights to ourselves, dealing with taking fish, the right of hunting, gathering roots and berries, pasturing our stocks on unclaimed lands within the states in common with citizens. On one of the pages in that handout, you'll see we're talking about the where. There's this diagram of a fairly large area. We gave to the United States 10 million acres. We ceded to the United States 10 million acres. Before there was Wasco County, before there was Jefferson County, Hood River, etc., is that that was quote-unquote owned. Ownership, something foreign to us as a people, but you know, we don't own, the Creator owns. And anyway, there was a debate about that thing called ownership back in those days. I reviewed some of the minutes just the other day. And within that, you'll see, I call this my job description, is that as Director of Government Affairs, I work both on and off reservation, is that the thing is that all of the color parts of the green and the orange almost and the dark green, I guess it is, and yellow, is that those are federally owned lands. And clearly, we have definite say in those. But a majority of the lands is that those are state, county, private properties. And we have, again, all of those, the resources like fish do not understand jurisdictions, is that they travel to many, many jurisdictions. And so to effectively protect, I think, our interests as a people on reservation, I think we all understand that that's our sovereign area and we're doing a lot. And I'm real proud of what we've done on reservation and give people invites to come on over and see what we've done and how we protected fisheries, how we work with our watersheds, et cetera, range, et cetera, and community. So the thing is that, again, we have to work with people that do have the more close-to-the-ground authorities out there. We have a kind of a trust-level authority that we need to work with folks to get it done. The next one here, you see on reservation, the Warm Springs Reservation is 650,000 acres, 1,000 square miles of land. I put this one in here. This is a depiction of our plan for natural resources and phase one IRMP, Integrated Resource Management Plan, and it deals with the forest. We have a bull trout problem, to give you an example. We have a real bad bull trout problem here. We have too many bull trout. And if you know anything about bull trout, the number usually is that there's not enough, and they're an endangered species, as Representative Gerard was talking to a while ago. Well, because of our management of our ecosystems is that we have clear, cool water, cold water, it's very cold, and we have bull trout that are actually very healthy in three riverine systems. We also manage the only species of wild spring chinook. They come off of our reservation, and Deschutes River borders us, and so we take care of those. On reservation, again, we work limited with the state of Oregon. Off reservation, with these off reservation treaty rights, we have, a real need. And I brought a compilation of our Indian Treaty fishing rights here, and there's a nice statement in here that really sums up kind of the situation that we have talked about. the policy of the United States to extinguish treaty Indian rights in Oregon Territory by negotiation rather than by conquest was firmly established in the Act of August 14, 1848, which established the Oregon Territory. This is from Sohappy v. Orrit Smith, which turned out to be U.S. v. Oregon at a later date. Again, we're doing our part on reservation, off reservation. We have, again, we have the classical situation of building relationships. I use a model in where I work with, you have three parts to any organization. You have issues of relations, you have issues of substance, you have issues of process. One of my biggest criticisms of, I think, government to government, and I appreciate government to government, is that how are we doing, in fact, with the actual real-world resource protection? What have we gained out of this relationship in relation to maybe doing it ourselves and being, as Don Ivey from Cole Quell says, is that that the tribes can't do themselves by persistence and charm. So the thing is that we have had some victories. I worked mainly with the Cultural Resources Committee, and we've learned a lot about relationship building and understanding. And I'm always pushing for us to try to push towards more substance in some of our victories that we have with the actual physical protection of cultural resources. The last document you have here is our wonderful organization. Real complex to me. Just, I mean, it's how do we get things done in our organization. I don't think you could put the state agencies on a single chart and be able to read those. And so the thing is that, again, that's why one of the, I think, the simplification of us getting face-to-face and forcing relations is that we've had to literally force this discussion with some state agencies because we really, they quite simply were very ignorant of Indian country and how to work with us. So they found out after a while that, gosh, we're concerned about the wonderful state of Oregon and need to work in a more trusting relationship. And then, of course, I'm always going to be pushing for this idea of more a clear process that's fair to both parties. Like U.S. v. Oregon's got a fair process, but it's under a federal court type of thing. We don't need to be paying attorneys to be our spokesman. I think client can talk to client in this situation. And again, our organization is that we're very proud of that. And probably the last thing I'll leave you with is that we need to I think when in doubt, you need to learn how to be able to, with that relationship, just ask, just whatever the contacts are. And we've had, I think, that probably bigger phone bill because of government to government, but, boy, that sure beats the heck out of paying our attorneys for us to talk. And so I appreciate the time here, and I appreciate, I think, the work that a number of the tribes have done. I think the Commission on Indian Services, as a entity here with the deaf leadership that they have kept the door open, and I think the tribes themselves, too, with our sovereignty that's, again, uniquely different, especially those tribes that clearly have these treaty rights off reservation. There's nothing quite like it in law. So when in doubt, you have to talk to the tribes about those. You don't talk to your attorney. You don't even sometimes talk to our attorneys. We have to figure out, you know, what's the problem first from people to people. And again, I think government to government is, although it's people can, oh, I remember one time working through a regime where poor communications was a problem with a certain entity, and so my boss's answers was no communication. Well, if they're not going to communicate with us, let's cut off totally. And I just, again, is that using the, like a marriage counselor talks about a situation, if a couple is still mad at each other, there's still hope, they have feelings. Is that, again, when it's quiet and nothing's happening, it's over. So we're still kind of mad about a few things with the state of Oregon, but that's good. And the state kind of scratches about a few things. Some of the answers are in here in the legislative arena. Some of the answers are in executive, and I hope lesser of the answers will be in the judicial front. Again, I appreciate the Efficiency Committee's time, and for questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Cruz?
Thank you. I just point out you're not alone. Some of us are mad at the state of Oregon.
Oh, okay. Get in line for that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Pitt.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House Bill, Senate Bill 770? Mr. Martin, you can testify or we can pass the bill.
No, I certainly won't be very long. Good morning, Chair Cromwell, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin. I'm the Intergovernmental Affairs Director with the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. We are here today to support Senate Bill 770. We feel that the government-to-government relationship is one that has been very well maintained over the past 4 years, and we'd like to see that institutionalized and carry on well beyond this administration. We believe that Oregon really has a future vision with respect to state and tribal relations, and we'd like to see that keep going. So thank you all very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Martin?
Okay.
Thank you very much. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 770, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 770.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill.
Move Senate Bill 770 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hill moves Senate Bill 770 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Girard.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to label or condemn all the members of the Confederated Tribes, because I realize that each tribe is its own individual nation. But because of the recent events in the Klamath Basin regarding the Klamath Tribe's position in regards to the Endangered Species Act, I must, by voting no, express the feelings of the people of my district.
Okay. Thank you. Any other discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative
Beck? Aye.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
No.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative McCoy?
Aye.
Representative Cruz?
Aye.
Representative Marks?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Semay?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Chair Cromwell?
Aye. Senate Bill 770, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And
Mr. Chair, may I carry the bill?
Representative Tomei, you would like to carry the bill? That would be fine. Representative Tomei will carry the bill.
Thank you.
And I close the work session on Senate Bill 770. Thank you very much. Let's see. I think what I will do is I would like to go to a work session on HJR 33. And okay. Mr. Smith, Chuck, did you have any comments that you wanted to make or answer any questions?
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I think it's more directed at 2057.
Okay. That'd be fine then. Committee, for your information, we're going down to get Paul Warner so that he can respond to some of the questions that we had with regards to, and while we're getting him, I think what I'll do is I'll close the work session on HJR 33. I'll open the work session on House Bill 2057, and Mr. Smith, why don't you go ahead and come on out? That way we can go ahead and keep moving along here. Committee, for these two bills, you have a new set of amendments in front of you. For 2057, it's dash 3. For HJR 33, it is a dash 5. And so we'll be able to address, keep our comments to those amendments, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chuck Smith, and I'm Director of Debt Management for the Oregon State Treasury. Treasurer Edwards had planned to be here this morning, but unfortunately was not able to make it and sends his apologies. We're passing out some material on stabilization funds in those 45 states that have those already. So it's just sort of background material for the committee. I guess I'd like to just sort of restrict my comments to two areas. One, the 5% reserve level. This is a level that is widely used, and if you'll take a look at or get the opportunity to take a look at the material I passed out, you see that 5% is frequently used in other states as a target point, although there is a wide range of targets for reserves. The State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, which is a statutory commission headed by the state treasurer and created to advise the legislature and the governor on bonding matters, heard testimony from rating agencies that 5% reserve fund, stabilization fund, was a very appropriate number, very common, and a number that they certainly were comfortable with from their perspective. With regard to ratings, bond ratings are important to the state of Oregon. A higher bond rating lowers the state's borrowing costs. A higher bond rating can save millions of dollars over the life of a state bond. Bond rating companies, when the state has visited them, and we do this at least once a year for a direct visit to update what's going on in the state of Oregon, have raised the issue of a stabilization fund or the lack of a stabilization fund in the state of Oregon in the past. They're particularly concerned about those states, and Oregon in particular, that has active initiative process without a stabilization fund. And their concern is that initiatives may imbalance state financing, budgetary concerns, and so forth, and yet there's no real fallback to look to in a sort of a permanent reserve fund. Recently, actually, I suppose in the last year or two, Standard & Poor's had an interesting article that they published and has said, what's the best way or how do you go about getting a state or how do you get your bond rating increased? And I think the treasurer provided that article to you folks the other day. And the number one thing on a list of about 10 items was either establish a stabilization fund or increase the deposits in your stabilization fund. That's the number one way. With that in mind, those two areas, the 5% reserve and the positive impact that potentially this could have on the state's bond rating, I would just stop and open up for questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Smith? Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Paul, we actually I switched over to the House bill so because it's what the treasurer was going to basically address. You want to address or can address both issues, though, correct? Why don't you go ahead and come on up? I'll keep the work session open on House Bill 2057.
Chair, I'm Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Officer, and I'm here to have a few comments on both the House Bill 2057, the Dash 3 amendments, and HJR 33, the Dash 5 amendments. What I've had distributed, those of you on the Revenue Committee are familiar with it, I call it my cheat sheet. It allows you to look at stabilization fund proposals, and of course we've had a large number of them in the legislature in recent years. And really, I think if you break these down, each of these proposals will have elements of these four components. The first and probably the most difficult is the revenue sources, because you have to draw revenue from the current stream and set it aside in the reserve fund until when it's to be used. House Bill 2057, the Dash 3 amendments do is essentially don't specify where those revenue sources would come from, deferring that issue, which becomes a as you know, will be a key issue to discuss. On the trigger side, which is really what I'm here mostly to talk with you about, there are three triggers contained in the actually four triggers, and they fit into these three categories that generic categories that I've labeled under B. The first is the economic trigger, and the economic triggers, what you're looking for is something that reflects or mimics a recession. A recession tends to be a national economic concept. There's actually not a precise definition of a recession. Historically, the dating of national recessions has been determined by the National Bureau of Economic Research, and they use a wide number of indicators to determine the dates of a recession. One of the things that is important to keep in mind, historically, we have been well into recessions before we've known it. We don't know it immediately, and oftentimes we'll post-date back when those recessions actually begun. An example is the last recession we had, 1991, the Federal Reserve actually increased interest rates during the recession. The reason being they didn't know we were in recession. They were mostly concerned about inflation at the time. It was with the gas prices rising rapidly with the buildup of pressure in the Middle East at that time. So we usually don't know when we're in recession. But there is a rule of thumb that's used when we look back and determine a time period as identifying recession, and that is two consecutive quarters of declining gross domestic product, and this would be inflation adjusted. That's a measure of overall economic activity. Now, at the state level, we do have a gross state product, but those numbers tend to come out about a year afterwards, and they're annual only. So they're not comparable to the national numbers. So in terms of looking for an economic measure that you get in a timely manner and that would reflect this rule of thumb of a recession, national recession, what the proposal has, and a number of proposals have included this, including House Bill 2007, which became Measure 89 last interim, uses payroll, non-farm payroll employment. This is a measure of overall economic activity. It's a consistent survey of business that's done by, it's federally funded, done by all the states, and it's done on a monthly basis, and it's done 2 weeks after the month is over. Those data are available. So what this measure refers to is the two consecutive quarters of declining non-farm payroll employment. Now, to give you some historical perspective on that, when that's happened, the last time it happened was in the 1991 recession. It was mild in Oregon, but nonetheless, it was a recession. We had declining economic activity as measured by payroll employment. The payroll employment seasonally adjusted declined in the fourth quarter of 1990, in the first quarter of 1991, and the second quarter of 1992. So that's the last time that this criteria would have been met. Now, we're actually getting fairly close to that now because the economy has slowed and it is growing very little. But still, the last quarter, for example, the first quarter of 2001, non-farm payroll employment increased at an 0.8% rate. So we haven't seen a negative quarter in payroll employment since the second quarter of 1991, so 10 years ago. The other times, and you can imagine when those times were, when we'd meet the criteria, were all in the early 80s. The early 80s were characterized by two recessions. There was a recession in 1980 itself, and in Oregon you had declining payroll employment in the first three quarters of 1980, so a nine-month period of decline, so the trigger would have been met there. Then you had what amounted to the shortest recovery in U.S. history was 1980, fourth quarter, there was some increase in employment, and also the first two quarters of 81. Yeah. And then there were three consecutive negative quarters beginning in the third quarter of 81. There was a one-quarter gain in the second quarter of 82, and then three more negative quarters in 82.3 through 83.1. So you had six of seven quarters were negative. And actually, 9 of 12 quarters were negative in that period. So obviously, you would have triggered this use of a fund at this time. And of course, that was the legislature was looking everywhere they could to try to find dollars to balance the general fund in special session. So that's the economic trigger that is used here. And I think it is historically, it has paralleled recessions pretty closely. The other triggers that are contained in the measure are that if there is what I would refer to as budgetary triggers, if there is a 3% decline in the general fund appropriations relative to the prior budget period. Now, there isn't a time when that has occurred over the last 20 years. I think that's most likely to occur if you were to have a large beginning balance in which you're able to appropriate for a biennium, so you have a large beginning balance, you're able to appropriate to that level, and then you have a very small beginning balance going into the next period, and you have a revenue stream that's declining. So that is probably likely to be the time that occurs. But of course, remember that whenever you have a big beginning balance, what that means invariably is that you've got a kicker, and that reduces your revenue for the next biennium, and therefore you're not able to appropriate as much as you would have without the kicker. So that, I think, is a fairly tight budgetary trigger and one that historically has not been met that I know of. The other trigger is under C, which is a quarterly economic and revenue forecast that projects revenues in the current biennium will be at least 2% below what they were projected to be in the revenue forecast. So this would, the occurrence would be with a sine die revenue forecast, a May 15 forecast. In the interim, that forecast declines and puts the general fund in a projected deficit of 2% or more. Normally, what would happen under current law is you'd have special session. You'd have to come in and rebalance the budget either through some type of additional revenue source or through reductions in the budget, or some combination of the two is usually what happens. So that criterion was last met in the 81-83 biennium. And I'm sure you recall the stories you've heard of seven special sessions during that period. Most of those special sessions, what tends to happen is when you're really scrambling to try to get the budget to balance, you leave very small projected ending balances. If that's the case and the revenue forecast goes down at all, you're back in deficit. And we have had a tendency, and I take some of the responsibility for this as doing the revenue forecasting in the 90s, you've had a tendency to have very low projected ending balances on your sine die budget. And the governor's proposed this, and the legislature has passed it, based on the presumption that revenue will come in above expectations. That's certainly been the case in the 90s, but keep in mind that that's not always going to be the case. And when we hit an economic downturn, it doesn't take much for a 2% reduction in revenue, and 2% now of the general fund is about $200 million. So that can happen very quickly. So that I would anticipate as a, but it hasn't happened since 81-83, but in my view, it would be something that could very well happen within the next several biennia.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hill.
Move the dash three amendments to House Bill 2057.
Pardon me?
Move the dash three amendments to House Bill 2057.
Thank you very much. Representative Hill moves the dash three amendments to House Bill 2057. Is there any discussion? Okay, any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hill.
I move House Bill 2057 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hill moves House Bill 2057 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
I think that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kifori.
Looking through this document that we received from Treasurer's Office, I want to know why we can't name ours the Counter-Cyclical Budget and Economic Stabilization Fund. I think that name sounds much cooler.
The Counter-Cyclical, that's a pretty long name.
That's why we're keeping it in statute, so we can change it.
Oh, if you would kind of just hang tight for just a couple minutes in case there's questions. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Beck.
I'm going to be voting no in committee, and with the hope that maybe someone might come along with me and going to explore a possible minority report that would, in the next few days, that might give us a chance to at least put on the table, on the floor, some creative funding sources that we can all talk about. And I would put that in the category of a kumbaya minority report.
A kumbaya minority report,
not intended to send up the flag, but just sort of heighten the discussion a little bit, offer an alternative view. I may not be successful at developing something that I may not get support from anybody else to do it, but I also may not find something I'm satisfied with bringing to the floor. But I do think the concerns I expressed the other day, I continue to share of creating these empty shells that makes us all feel good that we don't fund. I think if we want to create a fund like this, we ought to at least make the effort to identify some funding sources and fund it.
Okay, thank you. Make a notation that Representative Beck will probably be a no with a potential minority report.
Mr. Chair.
While I will be voting yes on this measure, I would like to say that if Representative Beck and Representative Cruz can come together in the next few days and agree on a funding source, I will be happy to support that minority report. It's a little challenge for you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Representative Gerard.
Just for Representative Beck and Cruz, I'll be happy to pass the hat.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Cruz.
This may be historic because Lieutenant Beck and I have never had a chance to do this.
This is what I get for letting you sit next to each other.
In fact, I've never participated in the minority report, so this could be way cool.
We'll see.
But for the reasons Representative Beck mentioned, I'm fully supportive of the concept in this bill. I just think it would behoove us to attempt to identify funding sources. Otherwise, we could create something that just is an empty shell forever. And I will also say that while I... All right, we're doing good. Okay. Paul?
I'm a Democrat.
You haven't met the condition.
Yeah, you're going to have to file with the Secretary of State on that one. But, by the same token, I don't think it's appropriate to make this constitutional one at this point in time. I know that's the other bill, but we will make an honest attempt to try to find, if you look through this list of what the other states have done, to be successful, you have to have something that's continual and doesn't necessarily put a whole lot in all at once, but puts it in over time. And so there's some secure funding into the stream. There's several things in here that are things we could probably do, and I think it behooves us to at least look at options on the front end of this thing and see if we can find a funding source that we can run up the flagpole and have people salute. That's a little advertising thing.
Thank you.
Very little.
Representative Hill.
Chair, I'll just point out that the rules of the House of the Masons that contents of minority reports need to be presented into committee. So, to be proper.
Thank you. Any other discussion? I would just point out a couple of things. Number one is that had we had a shell in place in 1999, we would have been able to utilize the tobacco settlement dollars as far as putting some of those, having a place for those dollars to already go, which I think would have been very important. The other thing I would point out is that there are a couple of bills, and as a matter of fact, the original House Bill 2057, which Representative Cruz didn't like that one either, did have funding sources listed in it as far as putting money in reserve, both in a contingency and in a continual. So that being the case, it was... I should note that there are other bills out there. I would also point out, of course, that the bill didn't get a hearing, but House Bill 2971 does note a funding source of 2% of the general fund, and that is always something that we could revive in another bill. I think that what we need to do with these two bills is we get the mechanism in place, and we give the legislature latitude as far as where it is that they want to, or where it is that they want to take money from to be able to put into the fund. So with that, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Beck?
No.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative Satori?
Aye.
Representative Cruz?
No.
Representative Mark?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative
Kamei?
Aye.
Representative
Bruce?
Aye.
Chair Cronin?
Aye.
Mr.
Chair?
Yes. Representative Cruz serves notice of potential minority report.
I've already served.
Well, not in the vote, you didn't.
I serve as well, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. House Bill 2057, as amended, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Please note that Representative Cruz and Representative Beck have, good old, what's his name here, have served notice of possible minority report. Is there anyone that would like to carry this?
Well, I would love to, but I would imagine Deborah would do.
Representative Hill, would you, Representative Kifori?
I'll carry it.
Okay, Representative Kifori will carry the bill. With that, I close the work session on House Bill 2057. And I'm going to open a work session on JR 33.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hill.
Move the dash 5 amendments to House Joint Resolution 33.
Representative Hill moves dash 5 amendments to House Joint Resolution, the dash 5 amendments to House Joint Resolution 33. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Hill?
I'd move House Joint Resolution 33 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hill moves HJR 33 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative March.
I think the statutory measure is a good step in the right direction towards fiscal responsibility. Sending this to the voters at this time without a funding source, without any operational practice, I think is ill-advised, and so I'll be voting no.
Thank you. Any other discussion? I would just point out that I think that sending the resolution out to the people, it does two things. I think number one is that it shows the people in the state of Oregon that we are very serious about making sure that we have protections against an economic turndown. I think the other thing that it does, though, is that it, while giving them a say in it, by putting this language into the Constitution, what we do is that we ensure that the legislature has to consider this as part of the budget on a biennial basis, because of the fact that while it doesn't say that the legislature must put money in, I don't think it's something that when you have this type of language sitting in the Constitution that you just walk away from and ignore. And so for that reason, I think that HJR 33 is a good move, and would appreciate any support on it. With that, clerk, call the roll.
Representative
Beck?
No.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
No.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative Kifori?
Aye.
Representative March?
No.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Cummings?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Crowell?
Aye. House Joint Resolution 33 as amended, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. I will carry this on the floor, and let's see. With that, I will close the work session on HJR 33. Thank you very much. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3613, and we have a list here somewhere. Joe Brewer. If you would come forward, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator of the Building Codes Division, and I'm very pleased this morning to tell you that a work group that's been working on House Bill 3613 has come to conceptual agreement on a number of concepts that are currently being drafted in legislative council. Our understanding is those amendments should be out by Tuesday at the latest. The concepts that have been agreed upon conceptually are a requirement for full service when a jurisdiction is assuming a new building inspection program. That's contrasted with our current approach, which allows a jurisdiction to choose any element of a building inspection program that they care to assume. That's created a patchwork quilt in our state with respect to which jurisdictions are doing what. The next concept stabilizes the process for coming in and out of the building inspection program administration. Currently, a building inspection program can be assumed July 1st of a year, retained for any period, then simply reverts to the state or the county. Obviously, that causes problems from the standpoint of funding and resources to meet the requirements of the program. Next concept provides for an appeal process, allowing individuals to request an appeal from the state or allowing an organization that represents more than 10 people. It's either 10 individuals or an organization representing more than 10 people to request a hearing. The division would then go in, conduct a hearing, review the jurisdiction's capability to administer a program, review the jurisdiction that currently has the program from the standpoint of what we've called economic impairment. That means, can the existing jurisdiction still retain a viable inspection program after losing the part that's been assumed by another jurisdiction? The next concept allows for new assumptions, but the requirement will be for the jurisdiction to provide a plan outlining how much revenue they anticipate, how much resource they intend to provide for the program, and what level of service will be provided. It also requires the jurisdiction to provide that plan for 2 years. So we'll have a sense as to whether or not the jurisdiction assuming the program will really be viable for that period.
Mr. Chair?
With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hill.
Joe, can you back up a moment in terms of you said there's a concept in terms of who could object? Run over that for me one more time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, the concept with respect to the appeal would allow either 10 individuals or an organization representing more than 10 individuals to request a hearing, make an appeal with respect to the jurisdiction assuming the program. The division would then go in, conduct a hearing, and in relatively rapid fashion make a determination as to whether or not the jurisdiction requesting the program is fiscally viable, can operate that program for a 2-year period, and would also evaluate the level of impairment that would be created for the program that currently exists. The goal being we'd want both programs to be viable so that the state or the county wouldn't end up providing the service for either program that went out of the business.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative March?
Thank you. Joe, basically, existing programs, whether they're full programs or not, would still continue on as the way they are unless there was some jurisdictional change, so that this doesn't really affect any existing building program that's going on now. It would only affect ones that maybe dropped out and came back or a new jurisdiction wanting to take them.
Mr. Chairman, Representative March, thank you for addressing an element of the concept that I omitted. Yes, all existing programs would retain their responsibilities as they currently exist. They'd all be grandfathered in to this new approach. Should one of those programs choose to relinquish the program, then they would have to meet the requirements coming back into the building inspection process.
Any other questions for Mr. Brewer? Okay, thank you. Mr. Landry.
Chair Crummell, members of the committee, my name is Joe Landry. I'm representing 3 trade associations that include electrical, plumbing, mechanical, and sheet metal contractors. In working with the interested parties on this bill, we've realized that there really is no organized, coordinated plan for the administration of the statewide building code. And there never has been since over 2 decades ago when we moved to a statewide building code. So what's been happening is that when new growth comes to a jurisdiction, they'll set up a sort of a circus tent for the administration of that building code. They'll take on only the most profitable portions of the administration, and they'll increase their fees dramatically for the overhead. They'll then continue to provide brief and inconvenient office hours, inconsistent interpretations of the code, and just in general poor service. And then as soon as the growth leaves, they drop the program, and the previous jurisdictions, whether it be the state or county, or will be left to sort of pick up the pieces where they're left off. As you can see, this is a really inefficient and an expensive way of doing things, and ultimately the cost is borne by the consumer. So what we're trying to do in this bill is not, we've agreed not to go after any of the bad jurisdictions that already exist. This is simply to prevent further fragmentation of the program and hopefully be a step towards finding a more, establishing a more stable, cost-efficient program for the future.
Thank you, Mr. Emman. Are there any questions for Mr. Landry? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wants to testify on House Bill 3613? Seeing none, help.
Adjourn. Madam Chair, I move we adjourn.
Would you rescind your motion, please?
Oh, absolutely.
Because it's a non-debatable motion. Thank you. Anybody else? There's nobody else who wants to testify? Okay, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3613. And committee, I need you to hang on for just a second. We have a small problem in House Bill 2057 and HJR 33 that we would like to go ahead and fix here so that it's a clean bill going to the floor. Representative Hill.
We in work session on which one?
I think I have to suspend the rules to
just open the work session. Just open the work session.
Okay. I open a work session on House Bill 2057.
Mr. Chair, having voted on the prevailing side, I move we reconsider the vote by which we sent House Bill 2057 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hill moves that we suspend the rules and reconsider the vote by which we sent the bill to the floor on House Bill 2057. Any discussion? There's none discussed.
It's not suspension of the rules.
Not suspension of the rules.
Motion.
Okay.
Excuse me. It's not a suspension of the rules. Okay.
Have we have discussion, Mr. Chair?
So,
You got to reopen first.
Got to reopen.
We got to get reopened first.
You don't want to get it.
Yeah.
So, okay. So ordered.
Okay.
Now we can.
Can you tell us what's going on?
Yes, I can. What we need to do is that in the dash three, there was a small drafting error. If you go to the third page on line 10, it says the proposed appropriation is approved by 3/5 of the members serving in each House of the legislative session. We actually had asked, and then we have another one on line 14 that says 3/5. We had actually asked legislative council to draft that at 2/3, and that got missed. What I would like to do is conceptually amend.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
It's okay. It's only on line 14.
It's only on line 14?
Yes.
Yes.
It's on line 10.
Line 10 is a different
appropriation.
Different.
Yes, you're right. You know that guy?
Okay.
So we don't want to change line 10?
No. Is that correct? Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Sure.
Great. Yep.
Mr. Chair?
It's only on line 14. Representative Hill?
I move that we suspend the rules and amend the dash 3 amendments on line page 3, line 14, striking the words 3/5 and changing it to 2/3.
Thank you. Representative Hill moves that we suspend the rules and that we conceptually amend the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2057, line 14, page 3, striking 3/5 and adding 2/3. Is there any discussion?
Question.
Representative Beck.
So line 10 above says 3/5 of the members in the legislature can vote to expand the
fund. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
On line 10, that 3/5 is in conjunction with the other economic conditions.
Mm-hmm.
If
those conditions exist, Mr.
then
Chair,
it's only a 3/5.
And 3/5.
Yes,
right.
Expend the dollars.
And the other one is if
it's an emergency that the governor
declares then by himself, regardless of
any reason.
Right. Any reason, he just wants to do it, then the bar is higher.
Okay. Yes. That's
I appreciate that.
And that's what it's supposed to be. Okay. Is there any other discussion?
Clerk, call the roll.
Oh, wait. Can we do it by objection? Okay. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hill.
I would move House Bill 2057 as previously amended conceptually amended to the floor for the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Hill moves House Bill 2057 as previously amended and conceptually amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
No, serves notice, possible minority report.
Aye.
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 No, so notice a potential minority report.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Accepted.
Aye.
No, I think we both.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2057, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Same carrier.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Mr. Chair, will we also be amending HJR 33?
Yes, and we're going to do that right now. Let me close the work session on House Bill 2057, open the work session on HJR 33.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill.
Having voted on the prevailing side, I move that we reconsider the vote by which it passed HJR 33 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hill moves that we reconsider the vote by which we passed HJR 33 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill.
I move that we suspend the rules and on page 3, line 15, strike the words 3/5 and replace them with the words 2/3 on the dash 5 amendments to HJR 33.
Thank you. Representative Hill moves that we suspend the rules and on page 3, line 15, of the dash 5 amendments to HJR 33, that we strike the words 3/5 and put in the words 2/3. Is there any discussion? Any objections?
Yes.
There's please show that Representative March objects. Any other objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Hill.
Mr. Chair, I would move HJR 33 as amended and as conceptually amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Hill moves HJR 33 as amended and conceptually amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
I didn't comment on this before, but I've been mulling over a little bit. I think my concern with this by sending this to the voters, one, I'm not sure it's absolutely essential. I see some reasons symbolically and maybe put some pressure on the legislature next session. My concern is that by putting something on the ballot that I'm not convinced will be advocated for strongly enough during the election, I think there's a risk that something like this could fail. The legislature has, in recent sessions, put a lot of measures on the ballot that no one then goes out and campaigns for. They're good. Many of them are good government changes that are needed to improve the way we do business. But there's no constituency or limited constituency for advocating for these measures. And the voters look at this and a pile of 20 some odd initiatives and referrals, and no one's really made the case for it, and they haven't spent the couple $1 million you need to sort of remind people this is okay. And they see something that involves money and they get confused and they just vote no out of for lack of great interest, and then something like this fails, and then it looks like we take the message that the voters didn't want a security fund, when that the real reason maybe they weren't properly informed. I'm wary of referring measures to the ballot from the legislature where there is not an absolute firm commitment from some interest group to spend the type of money that it's going to take to get something that is kind of nerdy, insider baseball, passed. We saw a number of good measures go to the ballot last general election that just, there was total inertia after the legislature set up. So I think my concern about this is more with the level of advocacy
that will take place once we're all out of here, we're all doing our own things, campaigning. I find it very unlikely that any member of this legislative body is going to put this in their voters' pamphlet or campaign on this in their town meetings and so forth. And I know there are people that will spend a little bit of money and will advocate for it. And talk is great here in May of the odd year, but come time to November or July of the even year, boy, people get other priorities. And I just would hate to see something like this wither away. I mean, there have been very few people testifying on this measure. There hasn't been a groundswell of the interest groups in this building here to testify and advocate. There have been some good people, the Oregon Business Association. I see Mr. Phillips here representing his group, and I'm sure those people will advocate and do what they can, but I think there's also a chance they get distracted with other things in life. So that being said, I would caution us all about sending a constitutional referral that may not have the energy that it merits.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Smith.
Maybe we can just get a judge to overturn it if it fails. Just kidding.
No, that's a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm a little bit, I'm assuming then that the good representative from Portland is referring that 2007 was a really good bill, because I'm just trying to recollect in terms of which measures we put out on the ballots that failed. And so I think that was the only one that we passed out that ultimately, failed, save the gas tax, and that was a referral. But I don't think, I appreciate what the representative is suggesting in terms that we need to be mindful of it, but I don't think the test should be in this body that when we think in terms of an issue should go out to the ballot is that someone shows up with a checkbook and is prepared to spend the dollars to advocate for it. I think in terms of we need to look at what's good policy, and I think we need to trust the voters that they will look at the issues and make a considered choice. So I would disagree in his conclusions.
Thank you. Other discussion, Representative Girard?
Mr. Chairman, it bothers me a great deal, but I am in agreement with Representative Beck.
Share your concern.
Thank you, Representative Cruz.
In spite of my no vote on the last bill, I'm fully supportive of the concept. My no vote there is because I'd like to find a funding source. Having said that, I'm not sure that it's appropriate at this point in time to put it in the Constitution. And we in this body tend to tinker with the Constitution probably a lot more than we should. I think the legislative piece has the safeguards in it to protect the fund. I don't think that we should amend the Constitution every time we have a whim to do so. The real test of this, if we get a fund and if we get money into it, is to see how greedy future legislatures will be in their attempt to try to get out something that we had put in place as a safeguard for a downturn in the economy. And my sense is that once it's there, if a legislature in an uptime tries to just raid the fund for their own purposes, the public would be outraged. But so I'm going to vote no simply because I don't think at this point in time on something this new and probably something that's going to need modification that it should go in the Constitution.
Thank you. Any other discussion, Representative March?
Well, I already spoke to the fact that I don't think this is ready for the Constitution in prime time, but I want each one of you to think hard about when you were talking to the voters last time, how they loved all the ballot measures that the legislature had put on and the initiatives had put on, and how they loved that big long ballot. So remember, you voting for a constitutional amendment adds to the ballot.
Thank you. I would just point out that, again, by putting this in the Constitution, the legislature can't necessarily ignore it. With it only in statute, one of the things that does occur is that all it takes is a notwithstanding clause, and either not funding the security fund is possible, raiding the security fund is possible by putting it into the Constitution. It's a much more stable situation, I think. And so with that, clerk, call the roll.
No.
Representative Graham?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
No.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative Contori?
Aye.
Representative Coon?
No.
Representative March?
No.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Tremaine?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Chair Trumbull?
Aye. H.J.R. 33, as amended and conceptually amended, has received the constitutional required majority and is declared passed, same carrier. I close the work session on H.J.R. 33, and I will, let's see, we will stand adjourned. Thank you.